So it turns out that there are ways that you can do presents wrong. And I'm still a little scarred from the first Christmas together as husband and wife. We were in Atlanta. Sherry's family, her parents, her older sister was married and had a three-year-old daughter. Her brother and sister who were single at the time. And Sherry and I had mistakenly assumed that our families were alike. We both described our dads as engineers who golfed. There were four kids in her family. There were five kids in my family. We sort of thought everything was alike. So it turns out we do Christmas very differently. In particular, we do Christmas lists very differently. So in our family, you were supposed to give a long list of things, and you were to hope that you would get one or two of the things on the list. In her family, you got everything you asked for. In my family, it was poor form if you didn't give people lots of options. So, Thanksgiving, my mother-in-law asks me, I would like your Christmas list. I want to be a good, dutiful son-in-law. I put lots of things on the list. Now, there's a couple other ways that our families are different. One is, in my family, growing up, we opened presents in an orderly fashion. You started with the youngest, then you went to the next youngest, and everybody watched everyone open every gift. In her family, you sit down and you open your presents. So I have like four times as many presents as anyone else. We, by the way, have given very cheap gifts because I'm a grad student. We got no money. So we're not really reciprocating in any meaningful way. I've got this mound of gifts. And I don't open any of my gifts because I keep waiting for my turn and it doesn't come. So just to make this even more unthinkable, the three-year-old daughter, our niece, kept coming over to me and saying, why do you have all the presents? Why did you get all the presents? I wanted more presents. Why do you get the presents? I'm dying just thinking, here, take my presents. Yes, you didn't need a skill saw, and this coat doesn't fit you, but who cares? Just please. And then I had another, perhaps my earliest Christmas memory is I gave a present to my grandfather. I'm four, maybe. I'd spent the weekend with my grandparents. I'd made something out of Play-Doh, and my grandmother had said that it was just wonderful and that I should give it to my grandfather for Christmas. Okay? It's made out of Play-Doh. I'm four. It's not wonderful, but that's what grandmothers do. So I forget all about it. She wraps it up a few weeks later. It's Christmas. It's grandparents. It's cousins. It's aunts and uncles. It's big, lots and lots of people. And at one point, my grandfather opens this box, and it's from me, and he pulls out this, you know, dried up Play-Doh thing. And he says, oh, Mike, thank you so much. What is it? And I looked at it, and I said, I don't know, but I think you're holding it upside down. And all the adults burst out laughing. And my cousin, after the laughter dies down, I hear my cousin say to her mom, that's not a real gift. That's a stupid gift. And I'm just traumatized that I've given a stupid gift. And I'm not even going to share with you my experiences in high school and college when I'm dating someone and you haven't really defined the level of commitment or how much you're going to spend. There's the year I went big and she went small, and it's sort of obvious I'm much more interested in her than she is in me. And then a few years later, different girlfriend, I go small, she goes big. And you really don't recover from that. Just it's just not the way it happened. So there are ways to get it wrong, and I want to suggest today that I would love you not to get a particular gift wrong. And I would like to suggest that many people really fundamentally misunderstand the nature of Christmas and what the gift is that God is offering to you. Now, Christmas is celebrated not just differently by different families, it's celebrated very differently around the world. And so every culture has its own songs, its own food, its own music, its own stories that we tell to children. But most Christmases around the world have been influenced by Constantine, who you may remember was a 3rd, 4th century Roman general who defeated another Roman general to become the emperor of the Roman Empire. And Constantine is famous for a handful of things. He's the guy that tapped Istanbul to be the capital of the eastern part of the Roman Empire. He calls the Nicene Council. He's the guy that does a few other things, including he is the guy who decides we're going to celebrate Christmas on December 25th. So he says the birthday of Jesus is significant. The incarnation is a big deal. And the incarnation, just so you know, it's sort of a Latin word, carnos is flesh. The idea is that in the fullness of time, Galatians 4, in the fullness of time, God the Son, who has been God from eternity past, chooses his parents, only person in the history that gets to choose their parents, chooses his parents and enters time and space through a virgin's womb. He adds humanity to deity. While remaining fully God, he becomes also fully man. And he does this incarnation, this taking on human form, he does this in order to reveal God, in order to love, in order to serve, in order to model what life looks like, in order to perfectly fulfill the law, and then in order to be the ultimate sacrifice for you to pay your moral debt and mine so that we can be reconciled to God and gain eternal life. Constantine, who has recently become a Christian, said, we need to celebrate the incarnation. We need to celebrate Jesus' birthday, and we're going to do that on December 25th. We're going to co-opt this little winter solstice festival that's taking place. Everybody happy that now the days are going to start getting longer. We're going to take that date right around there, that party, and we're going to make it a party about Jesus. So there's no historical reason to think that Jesus was born on December 25th. And in fact, we're told that the shepherds were out in the watching their flocks at night. That means it probably wasn't December. But when you're the emperor, you can do whatever you want. And he says, we're going to celebrate the birth of Jesus. We're going to do it on this day. And from that time, several things have happened that are worth noting. Number one, interest in Jesus has dramatically expanded. Okay, so in the last 1700 years, the number of people who have said, I'm in, like I want to declare Jesus is Lord, I'm going to follow Jesus, I'm going to give my life to Jesus, I'm going to accept Jesus, I'm going to, whatever people say, the number of people who say, okay, I'm following that person has expanded beyond anything else. It's the biggest worldview out there. It's the biggest faith out there. About 32% of people say offer some sort of allegiance to Christ. About 10 years ago, I wrote a book on Jesus, and I opened by saying, look, there's somewhere between 60 and 100 billion people that have ever lived. And Jesus is the most significant. So nobody has changed the world more than this carpenter from the backwaters of the Roman Empire. And it's worth noting that more books have been written about him, more music has been inspired by him, more art has been dedicated to him, and lots of the things that we just take for granted today, higher education, science, hospitals, these are things that were started. I'm not talking about individual hospitals, although that's true often. I'm talking about the idea of hospitals was started by somebody who is motivated by their allegiance to Jesus Christ. And I wrote this book 10 years ago, but recently a new book has come out called Jesus Skeptic. It's written by a young, award-winning investigative journalist named John Dickerson. And Dickerson said, okay, I've just completed my 10-year study. He goes, I'm an investigative journalist. I'm a skeptic. That's what investigative journalists get trained to be, is to question everything. He said, so the fact that somebody tells me something doesn't mean anything to me. I need primary data. I need primary sources in order to accept something to be true. So he spends 10 years and says somewhat reluctantly, okay, now I've reached the conclusion that the things that I like most in the world, the things that I think are the most valuable, like human rights and the elevation of the role of women and the anti-slavery movement and higher education and all these things, the things that I really like were started by somebody who claims that their motivation was Jesus. And he said, additionally, I'm amazed that when I see the people who are at sort of leading in a lot of these fields that I really like, the best, the most critical legal minds, the greatest historians and others, they're also stating that they're followers of Christ. He said, now I have problems with a lot of the followers of Christ, because I don't think a lot of followers of Christ actually are paying a lot of attention to what Jesus is teaching and saying. And I see a lot of things that I don't like, but I cannot get away from it. I'm now going in. I'm going to be a Christ follower. So lots of people are signing on. Christianity is the largest faith. It's the largest worldview. In the last 1,700 years, it has exploded. Second thing that has happened is that Christmas has become a really big deal. So you might have noticed. This year, in the United States, we'll spend just less than $500 billion on gifts. And the celebration of Christ's birth, Christmas, it dominates December like no other event dominates any other month. And Christmas has its own food and its own music and its own clothes and its own songs. It's got its own colors. It's got everything. I mean, Christmas is huge. So Christmas has become this really massive thing. And the third thing that has happened in the last 1,700 years is a lot of people have failed to make the connection between Christmas and Jesus. Arguably, more and more people fail to make the connection. And that's because some of the things clearly are not connected. So, I mean, if you look and you say, so what's the deal with eggnog and Black Friday sales and all this stuff, candy canes, how does this relate to Jesus? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. There's a sense that some people will say, well, we give gifts on Christmas because the wise men gave gifts to Jesus. But it's just our own tradition. And so I want to say to you, there is an idea of a gift that sort of inspires and informs Christmas, and it's in your best interest to understand the nature of the gift that I would argue God has made available to you. Christian faith pivots around a gift. The good news, the center of the message is that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. He sent a gift, his only begotten son, that whoever receives him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Now, I realize that some of you here do not buy any of that. You don't believe in God, or you don't believe that the Bible can be trusted in any way, or you don't think that Jesus is God. I get all of that. So different sermon. I would love to talk to you about that, but not tonight. So tonight, I just want to be sure you understand the nature of the gift that has been given to you by God. And to do that, I'm going to show you what the gift is not, okay? So we have some gifts here, and let me open this one first. So here is a gift, and this is not the gift. This is a weight loss book. Many people think the basic message of God is God's watching, and you need to get better. You need to do a lot of unpleasant things in order to raise your game, in order to be a better person. And so the Christian faith is a little bit like being handed a weight loss book. Now, I trust no one's giving a weight loss book to anyone close to them. And perhaps if they asked for it, it might work, but probably it wasn't a good idea anyway. If we were going to make this sort of a 2019 spin on that, I'd have a Peloton bike up here and we'd go down that path, but hard to wrap. And so we just went with a weight loss book. And I want to say, look, I understand why people think that Christianity is about saying you need to be better. There's several reasons for this. First of all, I believe that God has written some things on our heart. You know that there is a God. We cannot not know that there is a God. Now, we can suppress it, we can deny it, but it's a little bit like a beach ball holding underwater. It keeps popping up at inopportune times. God has written some things in our heart, and indeed, we also have a sense of standard that we realize we don't keep. So there is this sense that we ought to be better than we are, and that God is grieved by some of the things that we do. Additionally, we think this way because this is the essence of religion, and religion is everywhere. So religion essentially says to you, you need to do more good than bad if you want to be promoted at the end of this life, whatever that looks like, right? You need to do more good than bad, and you need to try harder. So that is religion, and the world is profoundly religious, and it was supposed to be getting less religious, but it's getting more religious because that's who we are, and I would argue we can't get around it. And then a third reason why you might think that Christianity says this is because, tragically, there are Christians who suggest this is true. Now, the Bible actually says the opposite. The Bible says over and over that Christianity is not this I do, it's this he did. It's not me reaching up, it's God reaching down. I cannot reach up. All fall short of the glory of God. We're all sinners. None of us can get it right. I mean, it's an ongoing theme. But God reaches down to us. We are saved by grace, by the gift of God. We're saved by grace, not through works, not of ourselves. It's a gift of God. None of us can boast. So that is an ongoing theme found throughout the Bible, but lots of people miss it. In fact, so many people miss it that one of the big themes in church history is trying to knock down the people that keep saying this. I have a friend who's a doctor, and he confided in me that a whole lot of what doctors do is just tell you back what you've said to them, only they say it in Latin. So he said, for instance, he says, you have a red rash that is sort of moving around a little bit. He goes, we call that erythema migrans. Because erythema means red, migrans means moving. So you come in and you say, I got this red rash and it moves around. I go, oh, erythema migrans. And you go, wow, smart. He goes, no, I just said it in Latin. That's all I did. But then you think, okay, there's something here. So look, theologians do this as well. This whole idea that I've got to earn God's love is called Pelagianism. And it's named after a guy named Pelagius who in the 5th century showed up in the church that Augustine, the great theologian, City of God, Confessions, the guy that did all this, he was there and he said to Augustine, you keep saying to people that God loves them and God will reach down and that if they will just accept this gift, that God will meet them and forgive them. And Augustine says, yes. He goes, no, you've got to tell them they've got to be better. And Augustine says, no, you're wrong. That's not the message of the Bible. So the first thing that I would say to you is that the gift is not a weight loss book or anything like it. The message is not God is watching and you need to do better than you're doing. A second thing that the gift is not is it's not a crutch. Now, crutches at Christmas time remind us of Tiny Tim in A Christmas Carol. God bless us, everyone. This is actually a real crutch, and there are several things that should be said about crutches. First of all, there are times when you need a crutch. Right? There are times when I've needed crutches, just like this, in order to get by. It's also worth noting that lots of crutches don't look anything like this. There's lots of crutches that look like a stiff drink or four or five. There are lots of crutches that look like ways to avoid the pain of life. And there's a lot of pain in life. It's hard. There are lots of crutches that look like other kinds of defense mechanisms. And sometimes those crutches serve a role. I want to also note that I don't think it's particularly fair to say that Christianity is a crutch. The implication is that Christians are weak and they need this father fairy tale figure that's going to sort of make everything be good in the end, and they can't face the facts. My observation is that a whole lot of the Christians that seem to get it right are remarkably strong people. I don't think Martin Luther King was a weak person. I don't think Mother Teresa was a weak person. I think they were very strong people, and I think that what we get called to when we follow Christ is often harder to face some things about ourselves and to some things that we may not want to be true, that are true. So I get that there is a scenario that we could tell that suggests that the Christian faith was started by people who were weak, who needed some pie-in-the-sky answer to try and navigate life. But there's nothing really in history to suggest that's how it was started. And I would also suggest that a crutch is a really bad way to think about the gift that God is offering to you. So that leads to a third item that is not the gift that you're being offered. And this is a rabbit's foot. So it's been a long time since I had a rabbit's foot. Remarkably, you can buy them on Amazon for not very much money. So Bezos has thought of everything. The idea here is that your faith is some sort of good luck charm. It's some sort of effort to supernaturally manipulate things so you get good parking or that life works better for you. Most people say they don't believe in this ultimately. However, there's a lot of talk about karma, and there's a lot of good luck charms out there. I'm just back a couple weeks ago from Turkey, and in Turkey, they have this thing called the blue eye that supposedly wards off evil. And you're told, oh, it's the blue eye. It's just sort of this gimmick that nobody believes in. And you go, okay. And then you look around and you go, well, there's one. Look, there's one in the visor of our taxi driver. Look, there's one, that person has one on their keychain. Look, as I'm going into my hotel room, there's a blue eye. I mean, everywhere you look. And my observation is that there's a whole lot of people who think of faith as some sort of effort to manipulate the supernatural realm in hopes that life works better. So just so you know, that's not at all the kind of offer that we get from God. Which leads to the fourth gift that it is not. This is the book by Blaise Pascal, prominent mathematician, philosopher, and writer who was also a Christ follower, and he wrote a book of sort of insight. I want to say that the Christian faith is not an offer to give you great advice. There are books of advice. There are books of deep sayings, like Deep Thoughts. I'm not talking about the, you know, Saturday Night Live spoof with Robert Handy, you know, Deep Thoughts. And I'm also not talking about the sort of imponderable kinds of things. You know, people say, well, God is the sound of one hand clapping. I'm talking about the kind of insights we find from lots of different prominent people, Greek philosophers like Socrates, or other prominent religious thinkers like Buddha, Gandhi. There's a lot of advice out there. And I would say I am among those who think there's a lot of value in looking at old books that are full of advice because it helps us see things and understand things in ways we might not. But it's very important to understand that the offer we're given is not that God will give us good advice. As a matter of fact, although there is a section of the Bible that we refer to as wisdom literature because it talks about how to live a wise life, part of what you have to understand is, part of the reason we have wisdom literature, part of the reason we are given the law by God, is so we understand that we need more than good advice. Now, I don't know when the last time is that you read the Sermon on the Mount. This is the most famous sermon ever preached. It's arguably the most famous speech ever given by anybody ever. It was given by Jesus Christ. It was a sermon he gave on the Ten Commandments. And if you read it, and if you haven't read it in a while, good night, it takes 10 minutes. You could read this. This is important stuff. If you read it, what you come away with is an understanding of, oh yeah, no, I can't keep that. Like the Ten Commandments say, don't murder. And Jesus comes along and he says, you've heard it said, don't murder. I'm also going to say, don't get angry. Or the Ten Commandments say, don't commit adultery. And he says, you've heard it said, don't commit adultery. I'm going to say, don't commit lust. And you go, okay, wait a minute. I got a hard enough time with this list. And now you're coming along with this list? There's no chance. And that's part of the point. We don't simply need good advisors. We don't need good advice. We need a Savior. So Christianity isn't about being given good information. By the way, there's another book that I didn't wrap up, but I almost did, and that's the book, The Ugly American, which was written in 1958. It was a novel that came out, became a bestseller, and it was written by a letterer and another guy, and they wrote a book and sort of coined this expression, The Ugly American. And most people, when you talk about it, they go, oh yeah, The Ugly American, I know. It's sort of it's a metaphor for the way American foreign policy can be heavy-handed and the way Americans, when they're traveling overseas, can be loud and obnoxious and they can be The Ugly Americans. I go, yeah. I go, have you ever read the book? And they go, I know all about it. And I go, so you know that The Ugly American is actually a physically unattractive American who's actually a really good guy and does everything right. And they say, well, no, that's not what the book is about. The book is about, you know, ugly American foreign policy and Americans that are loud and obnoxious when traveling overseas. And I go, oh yeah, no, I get what you think it's about. I'm just saying, if you've read the book, it's about a physically unattractive person who's actually very good and very thoughtful and is helping lots of people in this fictional town, this fictional country, Sarkhan, in East Asia. And they go, no, that's not what it's about. And I go, okay, let's bet. Because I've read the book, and you haven't, and you're telling me what the book is about. And I'm here to tell you, you're wrong. Lots of people have not read the book that helps to reveal the gift. And then they tell you what's in the book. So I lead a Bible study. It's 6 weeks long. It's for seekers and skeptics. And I basically say, look, if you want in the study, here's my promise. I'm not ever going to ask you to pray. I'm not going to ask you to believe. I'm not going to ask you any questions that will reveal the fact that you don't know anything about what's in the Bible. I'm not going to ask you to share your feelings. No one will cry. Basically, this is a safe study for men. So you can be in here, and I'm going to give you an overview of the Bible. And in this study, one of the things that I'll ask is I'll say, so what do you think Jesus spent most of his time talking about? Well, you got to be kind. Okay. Jesus is in favor of being kind, but it's not the thing that he spoke about the most. What else? Need to be nice. Nah, pretty close to kind. Anybody else? Need to take care of the poor. Very important to Jesus, but not what he spent most of his time talking about. So we sort of get a couple other answers, and then I'll say, the thing that Jesus spent most of his time talking about, the number one thing, clear in a way, it's not a close contest. The thing that Jesus spent most of his time talking about was himself. And he says, I am God. I am the light of the world. I am the bread of life. I am the way forward. I am the way and the truth and the life. I am the creator of the world. I am the judge of the universe. He says all these things, and people are like, yeah, no, he's humble. I go, read the book. Yes, he's humble. He lives simply, but he makes incredible claims, which are either true or they're not. But it is at the essence of the gift. So if I claim to be a 59-year-old father of three boys, receding hairline, bad golf swing, married 35 years, you go, okay, sounds about right. If I claim to be 35 years old, if I claim to be the smartest person in the room, if I claim to be the greatest athlete you've ever met, you think, liar and jerk. If I claim to be eternal, the one who created everything everywhere, the most important person ever, the one who will decide everyone's eternal fate. Then you go, completely taking a leave of absence. That's what Jesus claims. Right, so the most significant person to ever live, the one who has shaped the world more than anyone else, claims to be God, and he claims he is the gift. The gift that God offers to us is not good advice. It's not a weight loss book. It's not a crutch. It is a person, and it is a person who can rescue and redeem us. So that leads to the last box. Jesus makes seven I am statements. I am the light of the world. I am the bread of life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. He makes seven big I am statements. And one of them is he claims to be light. He claims to be the source of spiritual illumination, the way to understand who God is. And so the way we end this service every Christmas Eve is by seeing this light pass around the room. And it's symbolic of all kinds of things. But I want you to understand what you are being offered, and you will be offered the light, right, as it will pass down the aisle. What you're being offered by God, the gift that God is offering you, is himself. And that is forgiveness of sins, reconciliation to him, a call to be part of his family. It is a radical gift offer. That is what we celebrate at Christmas. So I'm going to invite those who are going to help light candles to come forward and the musicians to come forward. And I am lighting this candle from the center candle, which is the Christ candle of the Advent wreath. And we are going to see the light, which is a metaphor of Christ, spread throughout this room. The most amazing story ever told, I believe it's absolutely true, is that God so loved us that he showed up to rescue us. The gift is not encouragement to try harder. The gift is not a crutch. The gift is not good advice. The gift is not anything other than God himself, who showed up to die in our place.